And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the program, we're going to be previewing for you a remarkable documentary film that will be airing on PBS Friday evening called The Oratorio. But in part one, we want to talk about a brand new play that is about to open at Carthage College. And it is the latest installment in a very exciting series of brand new plays commissioned by Carthage since 2009, the New Play Initiative. And the latest installment in this exciting series is a brand new play called Patience and Fortitude. And it is written by an award-winning playwright by the name of Arlene Hutton, whose long list of credits include her acclaimed trilogy that begins with The Last Train to Nybrock, also Sea Rock City, Gulfview Drive, As It Is in Heaven, I Dream Before I Take the Stand, and many others. She's written a number of plays for young audiences as well. She has taught playwriting in several different venues. And this latest work, Patience and Fortitude, opens this weekend at Carthage College. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Arlene Hutton about her new play. Later in the hour, we're hoping to speak with the guest director of this production, Mary McDonald Kerr. But in the meantime, Arlene Hutton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for that nice introduction.
I'm very excited to be speaking with you. I read that you like to refer to yourself as an accidental playwright. Please help us understand that interesting turn of phrase.
Well, I started out as an actor, like a lot of people in the theater in high school, and I went to New York to be an actor and had college degrees in MFA and acting and did a lot in New York, costuming, all kinds of things. And eventually I got up into my 30s and started writing plays so I could be in them. So I originally started writing plays for myself and my friends because I weren't hearing our stories presented on the stage. And suddenly I found that I had maybe a talent for it, and my playwriting career took off almost immediately.
I know that your first play, I think, was I Dream Before I Take the Stand, and that was at some point in the mid-1990s. So it sounds like you hit the ground running. That is, you did seem to have a gift for this and also maybe some very good instincts, even though I assume you had not focused very much of your studies on the specific task or craft of playwriting.
Well, I've been in theater. Been doing theater since I was 10 years old, so I think that led me to an understanding of how to tell a story dramatically. I also had done a lot of improv, and so for me, playwriting is like improvising in my head. And yeah, my first play, I Dream Before I Take the Stand, is still my most produced work. It's a 20-minute piece about a woman dealing with a sexual assault issue, which in 1995 was not discussed in the same way as it is now. Most recently, it was presented in India, translated into Kannada, and touring festivals in India when the pandemic hit. It's been translated into a number of languages, and I'm really proud of that play.
Hmm. I wonder, before we talk about your new play, Patience and Fortitude, if we could just touch for a moment on the matter of the pandemic, which, of course, hit every sector of our society so hard, but in particular the performing arts. What can you tell us about the impact of the pandemic on you and the theatrical community?
Well, on the theatrical community, it's been devastating financially for a lot of my friends and colleagues and peers. You know, they didn't have work for a very long time, and it's slowly coming back. I heard of a Broadway performer who was doing food deliveries during the pandemic just to try to make some money. For me personally, I caught COVID very early, and April 2nd, 2020 found me in the emergency room with high fevers and COVID, and then I was on oxygen for a couple of weeks. And so that was a very, very long recovery that's actually still continuing. So personally, COVID is kind of a defining point in my life at this point. and something I've dealt with. And it made it very hard to write for a long, long time. The COVID brain was real. I had trouble focusing or even the desire to write. So that was in the middle of trying to put this commission together. So it's been a challenge, but I'm excited what we came up with and what people are going to see on the stage.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with award-winning playwright Arlene Hutton, and we're talking about her latest play, Patience and Fortitude, which is about to be presented at Carthage College beginning this weekend as part of Carthage's exciting new play initiative. Arlene Hutton, tell us something about the invitation from Carthage to craft a play for them, and if this is the kind of invitation that comes to you on a fairly regular basis. I mean, is this typically the way you begin writing new plays?
It's not unusual that I get a college or school reaching out to me and asking me to write a play. Sometimes I say yes, mostly I say no. The Carthage one is, you know, has a lot of cachet. They've had a lot of very well-known playwrights doing it. They have a wonderful machine in place in terms of dates for deadlines and working with the students and bringing in a professional guest director for me. So it was a really exciting opportunity. And it came just from an email. I had either been recommended to them or they had, you know, knew about my work and said, hey, why don't we reach out to her?
So an invitation like this from Carthage, is it a completely blank slate? Just write us a play, please, and make it a good one, of course. Or are there any constraints of any kind within which you were asked to work, within which to craft this new work?
Well, I love being an improviser. I love restrictions. I feel like I'm more creative the more limitations that I have to channel myself into. Certainly in writing for a college, they want, and I would want to write a play with a large cast. If you're hiring me, there's going to be major roles for women. I want to deal with issues that are going to be relevant to college students who come to see the play. And I want to write roles that they can reasonably play. So their limitations or their requests, let's put it that way, were also the things that I would want to do anyway. So it was a nice collaboration from the very beginning with Herschel Kruger, who runs the program.
So we will not see any 85-year-old grandparents in Patience and Fortitude, it sounds like.
Not in major roles. No, that's right. That is correct.
My understanding of the at least basic outlines of the story is that this is about a group of young people, maybe college age or certainly young adults, who find themselves, in effect, trapped in a remote house out in the woods. Tell us more.
That's
beyond
correct.
those bare-bone facts about the heart and soul of your story.
Yeah, one of the ideas I had was the idea of a British country house mystery, although it's not a real whodunit in the same way as a Agatha Christie, but just that kind of ambiance. The play is about fear and the unknown, which is appropriate in this world we live in these days. And so a house in the woods seems like it can be a fairy tale, wonderful house, or it can be, it can be very benign or it can be a very dangerous place, and it's hard to know which it is at any given time.
So what is it that makes this scenario so fearful for these young people? I mean, what is it that they are frightened of, or do they even know?
They don't even know. The internet has gone down, and so and they have no cell service. So is that a localized thing? Is it just the house? Is it the whole area? Is it the whole country? Is it the whole world? So if we don't have the internet to check up on things, how do we know what's happening in the outside world?
Hmm. Did anything in particular prompt you to include this particular element in your story, this element of the internet going down and, oh, my God, what do we do now?
Yes. When I was very sick for 10 days with high fever, I had no internet in my studio apartment in New York City, and I live alone. my building, nearly everyone had left. There were only a couple other people in my building of 46 apartments, and I had no internet. And I realized if anything happened to my cell phone, I would not be able to get help. And so that was my own fear. And that made its way into the play.
Wow. So you experienced that kind of isolation in your own life and drew upon that in the crafting of this new story.
Yes. Although, ironically, in talking about different ideas, that's one idea that had come up earlier, is what if the internet goes down, or what happens when the internet goes down, because at some point it will for some period of time. And then it actually happened to me. So it's life imitating art, imitating life, I guess.
We're speaking with playwright Arlene Hutton about her newest play called Patience and Fortitude, which has been commissioned by Carthage College's theater department as part of their new play initiative. The play opens this coming weekend. Tell us more about the process of shaping this play from initial idea into final form. And to what extent the process has been a collaborative one? I mean, is this the kind of situation in which you are sharing rough drafts with, for instance, Professor Kruger or others at Carthage, and then making adjustments and changes, or has it not been that sort of process?
No. You exactly described it. Because Professor Kruger's been doing this for so many years, they have a wonderful system in place for a series of deadlines and readings with the students. In a perfect world, I would have visited the campus four or five times to do either a reading or a several-day workshop or for the auditions. And the director was brought in very early. And so we did a year ago, we did an initial first draft reading. And then I continued working on it, and then that led to a workshop with some of the students where we had several days to work on it, and I would do rewrites in between the days. So it's been very collaborative, and Mary McDonald Carr has been just a wonderful, wonderful director for the project. She has a lot of background in new play development, has been an actor herself as well as a director. And so she really knows how to work with a playwright, what questions to ask, and how to ask them. So although it's been problematic for me in terms of my focus and energy, having been so ill, I've had the support that I've needed to get this play done.
Very good. Can you help us understand the nature of the sorts of things that have been rewritten through the course of this process? I mean, the typical sorts of things that would prompt you to want to take some portion of the play and actually rewrite it.
Well, I don't really know what I have until I hear it. For me, I trust my ear. And so I can write pages and pages and pages and pages of dialogue and numbers of scenes. And until I actually hear them read by actors, I don't know if it's going to work or not, or if it's even going in the right direction. So having those readings was crucial to developing this play, and actually any play that I write, I really need to hear it. So once I start hearing it, and especially once we got it cast and we're workshopping it with the actors who would be performing the actual production, I started it shaping it more for their. I started hearing their voices in my head. And started really individualizing and getting more specific. And also the questions that the students would bring up during our work together were really helpful in seeing which way I wanted to go with a particular character or a particular theme. It's an ensemble play, so every student has a large part to play, and indeed there are a lot of scenes where all 10 of the characters are on stage at the same time.
Tell us more about these young people. I don't mean the students at Carthage. I mean the characters in the play and I mean where they come from, why they are together, why they are in this house in the woods, if that doesn't give away too much.
No, we find out a few things in the first two or three minutes of the play that it's spring break. the dormitories have been evacuated very quickly for the few remaining people who didn't go away for spring break because of a rat infestation at the campus. And so these students, some students we find out were bused to a nearby motel, and then some of the students were bused to this old former president's home in the woods, which has been used for donor events and things like that, but that there are these 9 bedrooms. And so we found out very quickly the students had to leave their dorms immediately, and they were taken to the woods, and they anticipate that they're going to have a fun week with free food, and the weather's supposed to be really nice. They might hike in the woods, and then things start going bad.
Are these students at the outset friends of each other, or are they more like just acquaintances who are from the same school but not necessarily bosom buddies? I mean, this isn't, for instance, 10 people from the same frat or sorority?
No, that's a great question. No, a couple of them are longtime friends. A couple of them don't like each other already, and then a couple, like most of them, are juniors and seniors. One happens to be a freshman who they don't know, and one is somebody who's kind of out of the circle. So it's both. It's everything that you said. It's people that know each other and people who don't know each other, and you know, a lot of things that happen to play have to do with some shifting powers and allegiances.
Interesting. And I suspect we're also talking about an array of students in terms of what they're like, what they're studying, the nerds versus the jocks.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yes, exactly. And the question you don't know to ask is, when I was first trying to come up with different characters, I remembered that there's a theory in organizational management where in any group situation, be it a department, a committee, a family, all the characters in Winnie the Pooh will be represented. So in any group situation, somebody will be Kanga and will be bringing cookies and taking care of everybody else. Somebody will be anxious like Piglet. And so I loosely base the characters on that theory in organizational management. So all the characters represent characters in Winnie the Pooh. So it's kind of the dark side of Ashton Forrest in the Winnie the Pooh series.
Fantastic. So you are going to be present for the performance and for the final rehearsals, or are you already at Carthage?
I'm in town. I'm in downtown Kenosha at the Wyndham Garden Inn, looking out over Lake Michigan, even as we're speaking.
Ah.
And I was at the final tech rehearsal on Monday, the dress rehearsal last night, dress rehearsal tonight. I'll be at the preview on Thursday, and we'll be speaking to some students from a class or two beforehand, and then I'll be at the opening on Friday.
Marvelous. Well, I know so many people are tremendously excited about this this play that is about to open at Carthage, called Patience and Fortitude, and
yes.
It's playwright Arlene Hutton. Arlene Hutton, I'm so glad to have had this pleasure of speaking with you, and we welcome you to Carthage and to Southeast Wisconsin, and wish you well in all of your future writing, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you for being so gracious, and I hope people come and enjoy it. It is also funny in a lot of places, so I hope the audience will have a good time, and I'm really appreciative to Carthage for making this happen.
And now we continue today's morning show, the Thursday morning show on WGTD, by speaking to the guest director that Arlene Hutton mentioned in our interview, namely Mary McDonald Kerr, a highly regarded actress and director as well, who is for the third time directing at Carthage and at the helm for the production of this brand new play by Arlene Hutton, again titled Patience and Fortitude. Mary McDonald Kerr, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
One of the things playwright Arlene Hutton said about you is that you have extensive experience and expertise when it comes to the development of new material. So evidently, you have directed other productions in which brand new plays are being brought to the world for the very first time. Can you tell us more about that specific facet of your career as a director?
Well, that's funny. I have not directed new plays, but back in my Chicago days, I worked a lot as an actor at Victory Gardens, and their charter at that time was with new playwrights fairly extensively, and had the experience of, you know, being someone who was workshopping and giving ideas and then being given new material to do right up until, you know, opening night. So maybe about 6 or 7 plays down at Victory Gardens in the late 80s, early 90s, I was there for world premieres. I have not directed a brand new play before.
All right. I think now I'm understanding better what Arlene Hutton was saying, that very specifically saying you had extensive experience when it comes to the development of new materials, but not necessarily directing a new play. So this must be something of an exciting opportunity for you then, I should think. Ahead of us talking specifically about Patience and Fortitude, maybe tell us a little bit about the shift for you from what I assume was a career at the beginning focused on acting, which has now come to include directing as well. Tell us about that shift, or am I wrong? From the beginning, have you both acted and directed?
No, that's right. No, I was an actor, and my degree in acting, and was an actor for years, and was there as an actor in Chicago for about 10 years, and then I moved to Wisconsin and started to work in Milwaukee, started to work quite a bit in Milwaukee. And the way Milwaukee theater works is that the smaller theaters end up using a lot of the same actors over and over again. And so I got to know artistic directors very well. And the way that I approached plays as an actor, I think artistic directors recognize that I actually had kind of a very directorial process. And David Cesarini at Next Act Theater was the first person to offer me to direct a play. And I started directing maybe once a year at Next Act for about 10 years. And then that went well, and other theaters started to hire me as a director. And let me tell you, as a woman, it is a welcome shift, because things are getting better now, but when I was getting into my 40s, there weren't very many roles available. And so to be able to stay employed, becoming a director really, really was a wonderful thing, because as the number of roles got fewer and fewer, my opportunities as a director grew. And there are a lot of really awesome women directors in Milwaukee that had kind of the same path I took.
Interesting. This sounds like an interesting parallel to Arlene Hutton, who calls herself an accidental playwright, because she began playwriting because of the very thing you were talking about, that as she she entered her, whatever we want to call it, her middle age years or mature years, with fewer and fewer acting opportunities or fewer and fewer satisfying roles, she became a playwright to create the kind of roles that just weren't all that plentiful. And in some ways, you sought out directing for a kind of a similar reason. But you were also saying that the kind of actor that you were made it maybe an easier transition for you than it might have been for other actors. I mean, there was a natural shift.
I've always been fascinated with the way the whole play works and how the whole cast brings the story to fruition. And a lot of actors, and I'm not saying one way is right or wrong, but a lot of actors are kind of just are concerned with their own, what they're doing. And so I would get in trouble because I would want to have questions about what other people on stage were doing, which as an actor, you're not supposed to, you know, question that. It's rude. it was really, in some ways, a relief to start directing because I was able to get my hands on other aspects that I was not, you know, that it's not appropriate for me to have comment on, even when it comes to, you know, what set we're doing it on or what, you know, what I, how I think a scene works, that kind of stuff. So it was really, I love both. I very much love both disciplines and am happiest in whichever one I happen to be in at the time. And yesterday I started rehearsing a play that I'm acting in Milwaukee, and then we're teching all week, directing Patient Fortitude at night in Kenosha. So I'm getting to do both at the same time right now, which is a lot of fun.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mary McDonald Kerr, who is the guest director at the helm for the production of this brand new play by Arlene Hutton called Patience and Fortitude, the latest installment in Carthage's marvelous New Play Initiative, which has been bringing brand new plays to the world since 2009. Mary McDonald Kerr, explain what this process has been like, or maybe I'm asking more specifically, the role that you have played as the stage director in terms of the shaping of this play and then ultimately the shaping of this production of it.
Well, one of the reasons, our process developed as Arlene and I got to know each other and to know how we could tolerate the work. Not all playwrights would be so open to the feedback. Arlene really opened herself up to any and all feedback, from, including the student actors who were workshopping the piece. So it became very much a common goal, and so we all ended up with ownership of it, which is really ultimately what you want, because then the actors are really invested because they have an idea that they workshopped and that they get to be in every night. And so I ended up, we had two workshops, and of course they were by Zoom because the pandemic hit after the play was commissioned. And then I, you know, started by saying, giving ideas about just things that I liked or structural things that I thought worked better than others, and Arlene would run with it, and we ended up working fairly hand-in-hand throughout the summer. She would write stuff and send it, and I would say, you know, as I was directing it, we would say, oh, this story, this part of the story isn't forward enough in order for this other thing to happen. Can you write something here that will help us bridge this gap from A to B? And she would get to write something. It's kind of a luxury because usually you get handed a script and that's the script, whether you think it works or not. So that's very exciting. And but it's also, it's challenging, you know. COVID made it very challenging. You know, most plays take a really long time to get them exactly how you want them. So this is a, you know, a really great version of this play. I don't necessarily think it's the final version. I don't know what she will do afterwards. Mm. You know, but I think it's a really good production of a really good play, and that we all had part in birthing it. Certainly 90% are lead, but it's nice to see the stuff you had a hand in come alive.
Mm.
The students have had an incredible experience, truly, being in on making a sausage like this. You know, it's they've seen a lot and they've gotten to be part of it, and they've really, really gotten a lesson on play structure and how plays work, because they can feel how something's not quite working and then how it gets solved with the way the play is written. So that's really great.
Mm. One thing about the play is that it is, I should think, by its very nature, kind of a claustrophobic play. That is, it's one of these, it's one of those classic scenarios of a bunch of people trapped, not in an elevator, but trapped in this remote cabin in the woods. While that is incredibly exciting, I mean, if it wasn't a promising scenario, we wouldn't see it so often. But are there challenges for you as the director in terms of not allowing that trapped claustrophobic nature to in a sense work against the kind of the effectiveness of the play? I don't know if that question makes much sense.
No, it's a great question, because one of the challenges for these new actors, frankly, is how do you play growing frustration and fear without just yelling from beginning to end, right? Really exploring all the ways that humans feel those emotions, because you don't want the audience to get exhausted in the first 10 minutes. So that has been an exercise in nuance that has been, you know, challenging, but I think they've done really well, and it's very effective. And it's a study in human psychology, you know. You might think this one thing is annoying until you're exposed to this thing that's actually annoying, until you're exposed to this thing that's actually dangerous, until, you know, the level of that. So it's been a challenge, but I think that they have risen to the occasion for sure. Mm. And there's a lot of humor in it. These actors have also, because they're mostly scenes with 10 actors in them. You know, it's not a series of two-person scenes. So the ensemble work and the rhythm work that they've had to do, and the way they've had to depend on each other for support and storytelling, even when you're not talking, has been a real lesson in acting. And so we've all learned a lot, and it's been really fun.
Cool. How would you summarize this play or describe this play? It is a blank.
I think it's a psychological thriller. It's about the disintegration of manners when humans are under stress, and, you know, the onset of paranoia and fear. And it's kind of a fable to me. It's a fable of what is happening in this country right now. There's no escaping the fact that this play was written during 2020 when it comes to COVID and race relations and elections. And it doesn't take a side, but it's just about our human frailties when under those conditions.
The play, again, is Patience and Fortitude. It is the 13th annual installment in the New Play Initiative at Carthage College. The play written by Arlene Hutton, directed by Mary McDonald Kerr. It opens this weekend, and it runs the following weekend as well, with performances in Carthage's Wartburg Theater. And you can go to carthage.edu, click on The Bridge, and under the list of events, you can find information on how to reserve your ticket to come see this brand new play, again, titled Patience and Fortitude. Mary McDonald Kerr, thank you so much for making time in what I know is a ferociously busy schedule for you right now to have this conversation on The Morning Show. It was great to meet you, and best wishes to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. And to finish out today's morning show, we're going to be talking about a really lovely documentary that is airing tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. It's a documentary called The Oratorio with Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese essentially hosts this really beautifully crafted film, which takes us behind the scenes of the restaging of a monumental musical event in the early history of New York City, all the way back to 1826, if my math is correct, 195 years ago, the performance of what essentially was one of the very, very first classical music projects in New York City. And it was the staging of what amounted to an oratorio, what we would call a pastiche or pasticcio, a drawing together of a number of different pieces from other works together. And it was a work of great, great beauty and tremendous influence. In some ways, it helped put New York City on the path to becoming one of the central cultural centers of the world. And this all took place in the old St. Patrick's Cathedral. And the restaging of this work also took place there in that venerable space. This beautiful documentary about all of this comes from Provenance Productions. And I'm so grateful to be able to speak with Jonathan Mann, co-founder of Provenance Productions, whose previous films include Half Sour, Trashing History, and Do Not Duplicate. And he is one of the men responsible for this new film, again titled The Oratorio. Jonathan Mann, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning, Greg. Thrilled to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about the genesis of this project and what that genesis had to do with one Martin Scorsese.
Well, the church had, by a set of odd coincidences, been approached by a couple of Italian nationals, one a world-famous musicologist, the other with an opera company in Sardinia. They visited the church during a symposium up at Columbia University on Lorenzo da Ponte. Lorenzo da Ponte, of course, is the great librettist who did all of Mozart's most famous works, Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni. I'll get into da Ponte a little bit down the road because, my God, we didn't start out to be that interested in him as a protagonist, as a figure in our film, and suddenly realized, wow, this is a gentleman that if you played that game, who you'd want to have dinner with if you could go back in history, he's number one on the list. Anyway, these two Italians visited Old St. Pat's, came down from Columbia with an afternoon free because they wanted to see where da Ponte had originally been buried. His current resting spot is a bit of a mystery. He was reinterred out in Queens. And he met a tour guide at Old St. Pat's. The two gentlemen explained who they were. They came together with Jared Lomenzo, who's the organist at Old St. Pat's. And he, on his own, had discovered this lost program up at the New York Public Library while researching early history of his church. And he always had in his mind, you know, maybe one day we'll restage this fabulous one-night-only performance. And the two gentlemen from Italy were enthralled. One thing led to another. And there was discussion, maybe we can come back and restage for one night only next year when we're back with the symposium, this oratorio. And my background is primarily as a working historian. I love doing documentary work, but I'm passionate about history, and I was visiting with a friend who is at the church, who was musing about, well, I bet you didn't know, in 1826, the world's first truly great diva was here giving her a one-night-only performance. No, had no clue. Interesting. I bet you didn't know that Lorenzo da Ponte, having fled the capitals of Europe, ended up on the Lower East Side of New York as a poor grocer before getting discovered for his Italian artistry, culture, and language. And he staged this, no, didn't really know much about that. My interest wasn't quite piqued. And then there was the discussion, well, Italy is probably going to send, at their cost, as a gift to the new world from the old, an entire company to restage this performance that had been seen only once almost 200 years ago. And that was that. I was hooked. The incidental fact that this was Martin Scorsese's childhood church, he was an altar boy there, he grew up in a walk-up two blocks away, well, needless to say, for those of us who work in film, that was unequivocally the draw.
Right.
And so that's how it all started. And Mr. Scorsese, you know, call me Martin. You know, no. People like me cannot call him to his face Martin. Mr. Scorsese. He agreed. He's head of the Urban Oregon Restoration Fund. The church has one of the great Rolls Royces of music instruments, the Henry Urban Organ, installed in 1868, and Jared, the current organist, is doing his best to keep it going with duct tape and all sorts of machinations to keep it up and running. It desperately needs a complete overhaul and restoration, and Martin Scorsese agreed to lend his name to that nonprofit and in turn agreed to help us make this film.
It really is a lovely film, and one of the things I really appreciated about it is that you're not afraid to take on a number of different topics that are closely related to this central matter of this beautiful beautiful night of music being staged there at this lovely St. Patrick's Old Cathedral. One of the things I appreciate is the historic backdrop that you create for us, in which you help us understand what New York City was like in the early 1800s. You tell us, among other things in this film, that New York City at this time in the early 1820s was culturally well behind both Boston and Philadelphia. And of course, this big night of music helped to begin changing that. Tell us more about New York City and this part of New York City at this point in time in the early 1820s.
New York was still a backwater. I mean, it wasn't just Boston and Philadelphia that enjoyed the arts. Even Baltimore saw greater interest. New York was still finding its path, having emerged from the federal period into, it was growing rapidly as a center of commerce, but a lot of turmoil, as we note in the film. Old St. Pat's is surrounded by a giant wall because of nativist gangs, the Know-Nothings, those who aboard immigrants, and it was first the Irish and then the Italians, and there were churches burned. You know, they were decrying Catholicism and every element of who it was that was coming to the shores. I have to say, if any of your listeners have seen Gangs of New York, one element of that film that is incredibly accurate is just the backdrop. The people living in shanties on berms, anyway, there wasn't the sense of high art and most certainly operatic music in New York prior to this one event. This one event that Lorenzo De Ponte facilitated and was funded by a gentleman, Pierre Toussaint, who a freed Haitian slave who was a benefactor of the church. There's so many characters involved, we had to weed quite a few out. But the point of this one performance, it was a charity event to fund an orphanage on Prince Street in 1826, and that building actually still exists, just kitty-corner to the church, was the first staging of operatic music, Italian specifically, operatic music in New York. We believe some 2,000 people were present, and not just those of note and class, but middle income and parishioners, and it was something the newspapers reported on as creating a dynamic at the time of little girls suddenly wanting to learn to sing, to play the piano, to buy sheet music, and it extended, Greg, it extended to all the arts, and suddenly with this one event completely lost to history, completely forgotten until rediscovered a couple years ago at the New York Public Library, it created a wellspring that I have to say exists still to this day.
Jonathan Mann is one of the people responsible for this wonderful film called The Oratorio, airing on PBS tomorrow night. By the way, Jonathan Mann's father, Bruce Allen Mann, grew up in Racine. To hear more of our conversation, listen to the podcast version of The Morning Show. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be talking with two former white supremacists and talking about how they have managed to turn away from hatred and embrace new lives. Jesse Morton and Tony McAleer, who are speaking tonight on the campus of Carthage College with a presentation called Out of Hatred. This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, a couple of exciting programs from a long time ago. Saturday, from 1999, my conversation with Michael Schumacher, talking about his biography of the great filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola. And on Sunday, a conversation I recorded back in 2003 with Greta Van Susteren, formerly of Fox News. On Monday, I speak with Gateway Technical College's Sean Reardon, who is manager of the collection of data here at Carthage, manager of business intelligence. He helps various departments at Gateway sort through data related to what they do. He will be talking on Monday about a very interesting report recently released called The Demographic Drought, which talks about some of the profound ways in which the labor